Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We are seeking to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus, being equipped for the conversations of our day. I think of it as taking the headline news of the day, bringing the mind of Christ to bear, and then, you know, sending each of us out there into the conversations that we're going to have today, but doing so as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ, fully equipped to bring God's perspective to bear on real life in real conversations today. So if you go to my ministry website, which is reconnectwithcarmen.com, you can get today's Must Read Monday. Here's why you would want to do that. I don't have time today to talk about the stuff that's actually the breaking headline news of the day, because I've got three guests coming to join us today. We're going to lead off with Scott McConnell from Lifeway Research. He and I are going to talk about a story that broke during the show on Friday, and he was kind enough to agree to talk with us today about it, that our political divides are reflected in our congregational life. I think this is an interesting conversation for each of us to consider. Next up will be Monica Baker from Pew Research. She's going to talk with us about what Pew Research is learning about how teens and parents are navigating screen time and device distractions, all of those mobile devices that we have in our hands. And then I've got a conversation at the bottom of the hour with Rich Baker. Rich is an attorney. I actually know him from his leadership as a layperson in the Anglican Church here in North America. But Rich is an attorney who has a lot of expertise in the area of zoning in relationship to churches and other religious institutions. And so he and I are going to talk about what churches need to be thinking about in terms of zoning as the culture gets more and more secular, and having a church in the neighborhood is actually, frankly, not something that people find as a great value or even necessarily want. And so he and I are going to talk about that. So it's going to be all the way at the Connecting Point at the bottom of the hour, when I'm going to get the opportunity to talk through one of the headline news stories of the day. So the one that I'm going to talk through is about Senator John McCain's death, and we're going to reflect on him as a person of faith in addition to being such a magnificent, wonderful public servant. But that means I don't have time today to talk about the headline news related to the Pope. And I really want to talk about that. So we're certainly going to get to that at some point this week. But if you go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and grab the Must Read Monday, you can see what I'm reading in relationship to the unfolding story related to how much did Pope Francis know and when did he know it in relationship to these sexual abuse allegations that we are now talking about here in the United States. Then I've got a little reflection today about PETA. PETA is the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and I absolutely think animals should be ethically, let me get the right word there, treated. We should never be abusing animals. We are the stewards of God's good creation. However, PETA's latest campaign is to convince us that to eat crabs, if you live in Maryland, or eat lobsters, if you live in Maine, is equivalent to cannibalism because, you know, crabs are people too. Now, certainly you and I know people who are crabs, but crabs are not people. And so I've got some reflections on PETA and what PETA should be paying attention to, which is, in my view, not crabs and lobsters, but the actual abuse that's happening to animals in America by their owners, who are so desperate to get access to opioids and narcotics that they are actually intentionally abusing their animals so that they can take them to the vet so that their animal can get some kind of narcotic prescription that the person would then take. This is the devastating reality of not only opioid addiction, but our absolute loss of the sense of ourselves as the agents of God's grace and the stewards of the good creation which he has made and entrusted to our care. So PETA should busy themselves on that front and not worry so much about crabs and lobsters. But I've got that posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com as well. And then finally, in my Must Read Monday, I've got a little bit of analysis of the news related to Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin. And this is in relationship to Title VII, which is a part of the Civil Rights Code here in the United States of America. This is going to be a story that is is going to be top of news in terms of the ongoing conversation about discrimination and what it means here in America. What does sex mean? What does gender mean? And what does it mean in terms of employment law? So that's going to be a story you're going to want to read in on, and we will talk about it at a later date here on Connecting Faith. But right now, I am going to bring Scott McConnell on the line. Scott is the executive director of Lifeway Research. He's a friend of Connecting Faith. He comes on frequently. So, Scott, welcome to the show today.
Carmen, great to be with you.
All right, so you and I are going to talk about this latest research, which is posted for folks at lifewayresearch.com, that the political divides in the church, are pretty significant. Tell us what you all learned.
We asked American churchgoers if their political views matched those of most of the people at their own church. And it turns out that only half agree with that, that they actually match. And maybe the more interesting number is that 30% are not even sure if their views match those of their congregation. And so the only way that many people could not be sure is if there's actually 3 out of 10 churches that are not talking about political things on a regular basis, because most churchgoers have been at their church a long time. 6 out of 10 have been at their church 10 years or more. So to not know where people stand politically is a little bit odd. But of those who know, half agree we're matching on our political views, and only 1 out of 5, 19%, disagree. So far more are saying we're on the same page politically than say we're in a different place.
So the thing about this research that actually surprised me was the point that you just pulled out for us, and that was this, because I'll just read it back to you, which you've obviously already know because you said it. This is a quote, guys, of Scott McConnell on the Baptist Facts and Trends page. It's about the Lifeway research that's just recently done about how political views match up with people next to us in the pews of our churches. Scott, you said more than a few churchgoers in the most recent study, 30%, in fact, don't know the political views of the people beside them in the pews. Politics isn't the only thing churchgoers care about. In some churches, politics isn't mentioned at all, at least in the pews. Scott, here's my observation related to that, and I don't know if we have a research answer to this question, but if we're in a spectator-style church and I'm not actually in relationship and fellowship with the people who are next to me in the pews, I may actually have no idea what their political views are.
That's a great point, because as we've surveyed different churches, we find that about 2/3 of folks are typically involved in a small group of some kind, whether they call it a Sunday school class or it's a Bible study of some kind. And it's in those settings that typically you get to know people and you have discussions and do a little more application in a conversational manner. So it's possible that a quarter, even a third of the church could be more just in the spectator-type settings of coming to a worship service and hearing from the pastor but not actually discussing it with others to know where others could stand. And, that's definitely a gap where, the Christian life is meant to be done together. And so when we don't have those conversations, a lot of the application of biblical principles to life sometimes gets left to the side, and that includes our views on what's going on in our government and in our culture.
So I think that, there were a lot of folks who were raised to think that in polite company, there's 3 things that we don't talk about. 2 of those are religion and politics. In our culture, we now talk about sex all the time. So apparently we have overcome that particular hurdle. But when we think about the open conversations that we either have or don't have in the context of our Christian communities, aka churches, about politics, my guess is that that folks don't want to have open disagreement with their pastor or their church leadership if it's a church that they love for other reasons. Like they're willing to stay in a church where the politics are different than their own position.
We actually asked a question on a previous release where we said if the political views in your church were expressed that differed from yours, would it actually cause you to strongly consider changing churches? And 9% of churchgoers said that it would. And so, there's this small group, 1 out of 10 roughly of churchgoers who are thinking my politics has to line up with my church. And you know, I think for a lot of churchgoers, we're used to things being aligned because our doctrine is it tends to be aligned with others we attend church with. And so so the biblical side of things tends to be aligned. In fact, 94% say that their spiritual beliefs are mostly or completely aligned with their church. So when we get into a political arena where you could be picking one verse to address a topic, I could be picking another, and we're both true that those verses apply to that situation, but I'm latching onto my verse more than the one you're looking at, we could come to two different conclusions politically.
Right. And I think that one of the things that this research shows is that people maybe who are more mature generationally are more comfortable living in the complexity of the conversation versus those who are younger, because it did seem as if the research suggested that the younger the demographic, the more important it seemed to the churchgoer that they go to a church that aligned with their political views.
That's so true, because we followed up with a question asking about their preference. Do they prefer to attend the church where people share your political views? And if we look at it overall, it's split right down the middle. 46% agree, 42% disagree. But if we look at it by age, the majority of churchgoers under the age of 50, 57%, want to be attending with people who match their political views. That drops to 39% for those in their 50s and early 60s, and those age 65 plus within the church, only a third are agreeing with that. And so as you said, kind of as people are aging, there's a little bit of wisdom there that this is a little more complex, that that politics touches on a lot of things, and we need to be applying our biblical beliefs to those issues. And the needs in our society involve morality. They involve justice. Those are things that are in the scripture. But politics also involves different methods, the how we're going to go about solving our society's problems. And we can come to two different conclusions at times.
Or even a spectrum of answers. So, yeah. Scott McConnell, thank you so much for joining us again today on Connecting Faith. We love talking with you about what you guys are doing at Lifeway Research. Friends, you can read this research at lifewayresearch.com. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey, friends, next up, a little more research. Monica Baker is going to be here from Pew. You can check out what we're talking about at pewinternet.org. We're going to talk about how teens and parents navigate screen time and device distractions. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm being joined by Monica Anderson. She is a senior researcher with Pew Research. Monica spends a lot of her time looking at the intersection of the internet and technology and then real life, what real people are doing. Much of her recent work has focused on the impact of the digital divide, the growing role of automation, in everyday life. And activism in the age of social media. So there's lots of things we could talk about with Monica. Today we're going to focus in on some new research just released by Pew. You can check it out at pewinternet.org on how teens and parents navigate screen time and device distractions. Monica, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hi, Carmen. Glad to be here today.
So, well, we're thrilled to have you. We have talked a fair amount here on the program about access to digital, the question that parents are asking, whether or not, when, and all those things related to giving their young people access to just that wide open, kind of the Wild West of what's available on the internet and certainly through devices. We talk about screen time, but this is the first research that I've seen that's asking the question of teenagers. How do they feel about the amount of time they're spending on their mobile devices? So tell us what you found out.
Yeah, so one of the things that we wanted to measure is kind of how do teens assess their own relationship with technology, and specifically with their cell phones. There's been a lot written about teens always having their face in their phone and concerns about screen time. So we asked teens whether or not they felt as if they spent too much time on their phone, about the right amount of time, or too little time. And what we found is that a little more than half, so 54% of U.S. teens, say that they felt that they spent too much time on their phone. And we asked a similar question when we looked at social media use as well as video games. So about 4 in 10 teens say they spend too much time on social media, and about a quarter say they spend too much time playing games.
So one of the things I appreciate about this is you guys actually, you know, you've given us questions that we can turn around and ask our own students. You know, like, this empowers me as a parent to be able to say, hey, let's talk about how you feel about whether or not you're spending too much time on your cell phone or with social media or on video games. Because what I appreciated about this, Monica, is that when you say that they not only feel like they spend too much time on their cell phones, they also report more than half of them are actually taking steps to cut back on their use of their mobile phone or trying to cut back on social media or video games. That's pretty amazing. More than half of the teens that you surveyed have, at one point in time at least, tried to limit their own use of these new technologies.
Yeah, that's true. So 52% of teens told us that they tried to cut back on the amount of time they spend on their cell phone. About 57% say the same as social media, and a similar share say the same when it comes to playing video games. So in that sense, teens are really kind of clued into this being a potential issue impacting them and other ways also impacting their peers. So we asked another question on kind of whether or not they thought that people their age spending too much time online was a major, minor, or not a problem for teens their age. And the vast majority of teens, so around 9 in 10, said that it was a problem, and about 6 in 10 said it was a major problem. So teens are clued into this as a larger problem impacting people their age, and they're also clued into it in terms of their own personal use.
So I found the feelings question a really instructive one. Mm-hmm. I think that the question about how they feel when they're separated from their cell phone. Tell us what you found about that, because I think that these feeling words are really significant when we start talking about how we as parents or educators or whatever our role and intersection might be with young people, when we demand that they give up their cell phones or leave them, you know, somewhere else. Tell us how they're feeling when they're separated from those devices.
Yeah, so in our survey, we asked teens 5 different emotions that they might feel when they don't have their cell phone. So we asked whether or not they feel anxious without it, lonely, upset, even relieved or happy, or whether or not none of these emotions kind of fit how they feel. And by far, the biggest response came when we asked about anxiety. So 42% of teens in the U.S. say they feel anxious when they don't have their smartphone. About a quarter say they feel lonely, and a similar share say they feel upset. So when taking those 3 kind of negative emotions into account, more than half of teens expressed feeling at least one of these kind of negative feelings when they don't have their cell phone.
I sort of linked that in my reading of your research. I kind of linked that in my mind to the fact that so many of them, the very first thing that they do when they wake up is check their phone. I mean, they've
That's clearly true.
Been sort of sleeping with anxiety.
Yeah, so we asked another question about what do they do with their phones and kind of their relationship with technology and how pervasive it might be. And a majority of teens, so 72%, say they check their phone messages as soon as they wake up. And in another report that we did earlier this year, so this is kind of we're doing like a year-long look at teens and tech, we found that 95% of teens today have access to a smartphone. And so that's nearly universal, and that's a big jump from the last time we polled teens in 2014 or 2015. So that's a jump of about 20 percentage points. So in many ways, a lot of these issues, you know, it's not that they're brand new, but the salience of smartphone use is really a new phenomenon among teens.
And I don't, and we don't yet know its sort of long-term impact. So it's really helpful that you are bringing us this kind of information. Again, friends, my conversation partner is Monica Anderson. You can find the report that we're talking about at pewinternet.org under How Teens and Parents Navigate Screen Time and Device Distractions. Monica, one final question before we've got to take a break, and that's in relationship to parents, because one of the things that you all discovered is that parents aren't a whole lot better at this.
Right. You know, the conversation around technology and the relationship with technology is something that impacts people of all ages. And in this report, we have the unique opportunity to be able to ask teens as well as parents of teens some of those similar questions. So while about 70% of teens say they check their phone as soon as they wake up, about 60% of parents say the same thing. And we also asked a question about losing focus. So 39% of parents of teens say that they lose focus when they're at work because they're checking their phone, which is a higher share than the share reported among teens. So about 30% of teens said the same thing. We also asked one of the fun findings from this survey is we asked parents how often they felt their teen was distracted when they were trying to talk to them in person. And we asked the same of teens. So about half of teens said that their parent was at least sometimes distracted when they're trying to talk to them, and about 15% say that that happens all the time. So in ways you see that this isn't just about teens. Parents also struggle with these issues as well.
Monica Anderson, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith. Friends, you can find this at pewinternet.org. You can follow Monica on Twitter. Let me get this correct. At Monica R. Anders. Monica R. Anders. Monica, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Okay, friends, so next up, I'm going to be talking with Rich Baker. Rich is an attorney who works with a wide variety of clients, including churches. Churches and other religious nonprofits face particularly interesting legal challenges today as the culture becomes increasingly secular. And oftentimes, neighborhoods fail to see the value of having religious institutions in their neighborhood. So, you know, folks are trying to figure out conversations and questions related to what I'm going to put under the giant category of zoning laws. So you're thinking to yourself, wow, Carmen's a little bit all over the map today. She's talking about politics in the pews. She's talking about technology in relationship to teens. And now she's going to be talking about zoning in relationship to churches. Well, yeah, that's because I'm actually trying to have the kinds of conversations that you and I, whether or not we're actively having them, some of them we need to be having. And there's some stuff that we need to be thinking about in advance of the need to think about it. So the congregation where I worship is in the midst of a conversation about building another building in addition to the buildings we already have. And so I have been getting up to speed on everything related to church buildings and building churches. So I'm going to talk with Rich Baker right after the break. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Stay with us. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We are talking with Rich Baker. Rich is a law partner in a firm that we like to talk with frequently because, you know, frankly, they are lawyers for Jesus. It's my best way of saying it. They actually have a radio program by that name. So, Rich, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for having me on. It's fun to be on the other side. I do a lot of the interviewing, so this is great.
Then do I have the name of your program correct?
You do. And you know what? I always laugh at that program. That is who we are, Lawyers for Jesus. My wife said, couldn't you be a little more subtle? And I just said to her, no, we can't. That's who we are. So, yes.
All right. I love it. So, friends, if you want to find their program, I feel certain it's on every podcasting platform out there. It's Lawyers for Jesus. So, Rich, let's start with a wide open conversation about zoning laws related to churches. People might hear reference to RLUIPA. What is RLUIPA, and what do we need to know about it?
Well, RLUIPA is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, and it was passed almost, I don't even want to say almost, it was passed miraculously in about 2000 under President Clinton, and it had sat for a very, very long time, and then all of a sudden, in a very short period of time, we're talking less than a week, it passed both houses and then was signed. So, and it had been fought for a long time. It is the last religious piece of legislation where both the Christian Legal Society and the ACLU were on the same side of the table. Ever since then, religious issues have been a contention. The ACLU pretty much going in the direction of gay rights and seeing as religious freedom as a problem for the advancement of gay rights. So it was the last act, and what it does is it specifically attempts to level the playing field for religious organizations when they're applying for zoning.
Okay, so it's my understanding that under RLUIPA, which basically says, you know, a religious congregation or assembly or institution has to be treated the same as a non-religious assembly or institution. So I feel like that means that cities cannot discriminate against churches. But you tell me that cities discriminate against churches all the time.
This is true. First of all, some municipalities don't know about RLUIPA yet. It's only been on the books for 18 years. Other municipalities really don't care about what's on the books. We had one municipality down south of Chicago, and they were discriminating against a small black church that we were representing. And when we went to them, there wasn't even a provision in the zoning code that they were attempting to apply. And so we said, hey, that's not in your code. And the administrator said, I am the zoning code. And so we see that different municipalities have different views. Now, not all of the discrimination that takes place is religious-based with regard to churches. There are three issues. If you go into a residential area, many times it's the residents, and it's not that they hate Christians. It's they hate noise, they hate parking, and they're fearful that they're going to get a mega church, which will disrupt their neighborhood. So that's oftentimes an issue, and that's not necessarily religious discrimination. The second reason is if you go into the other areas that are non-residential, churches are exempt from taxes, and so municipalities hate the thought of the loss of revenue. So all of those factors play in and make churches oftentimes not welcome anywhere.
So it's hard to imagine that we've arrived at a day and a time when a local community would not want a church to buy an existing church, to move into an occupied space and rehab it, or to actually build on vacant land. But what you're saying is you are seeing across America examples of places where people just don't want churches to move in.
Very definitely that's what I'm saying. And yes, our firm does work on cases across America, and this is it's a very common theme. It used to be that churches were welcome in residential areas. That's no longer the case. And it is true that wherever you go, if you're a new church, you have to look at your zoning very, very carefully. And you mentioned if you're moving into an existing church. Generally, if you're moving into an existing church, you're already zoned for that purpose, and that's not going to be a problem. But if you intend to change that church in any way, let's say add to it or remodel it or add parking or things like that, then oftentimes the municipalities can give you a great deal of trouble. We have had several of those cases out on the East Coast where they moved into an existing church, and actually if they can't get you on the zoning code and they don't want you there, they will use the building code, or they'll do and make it so prohibitive for you to renovate your building that you can't get the permit. Things like sprinklers and all kinds of things like that. That can be very, very expensive.
Let me remind our listeners that I'm talking with Rich Baker. Rich, how can people find you if they want to track you down?
Firm is Mauch & Baker, and we're located in Chicago. Our number is 312-726-1243, and we're on the web as well, and it's mauchbaker.com. You can get me at rbaker@mauchbaker.com.
So we're talking, friends, about zoning laws and the experience that churches are having across the country. Rich, why don't you give us an example of a current situation you're dealing with?
Okay, I won't name the municipality, but actually on my desk right now is a letter I'm drafting to a municipality, and I have a client that wants to do a 10-year lease in a shopping center area, plenty of parking, and that particular municipality does not allow churches basically anywhere except for one very small area in the entire municipality. And yet the city is in favor of this church going in, and so obviously I flagged the zoning code, and they're in a dilemma because they want to let us come in, but they don't allow churches. And so they're trying to work out a deal with us without acknowledging that they don't allow churches in any area, but not tipping off everybody else on it at this point. And so we'll see where that goes. It's of course, for the church that I represent, they will be putting in $400,000+ worth of renovations. And if they don't have a clear right to zoning, all of that could be up in smoke. And, you know, if the regime in the municipality changed their mind and decided they didn't want the church there or something like that. So the zoning is a very, very serious issue.
Hey, Rich, I wonder if you know about this situation in Laurel, Maryland, about this Redemption Community Church. Are you familiar with this story at all? It sounds like...
No, I'm not. I'm not. My partner, Chana, my area is mostly... I work with the municipalities very closely. I always say when I lose it, then I give it to my partner, John Mauch, to litigate it. But so...
We talked to John about Jesus in the courtroom, and that was a fun conversation.
Yeah. My partner's a wild guy. I love practicing with him. We've been working together since 1986. So, wonderful guy.
So, Rich, let's just have a more general conversation about your experience as a Christian whose vocation is, to be an attorney. I'm guessing that you have some experiences where because you even referenced this earlier, that, you know, some things happen either positively or negatively that you really cannot say were sort of like the effect of a natural cause, but definitely where something spiritual is going on. I'm wondering if as we're helping churches consider the challenges that might be out there in relationship to, you know, building something new or doing something to an existing facility, what kind of spiritual warfare and preparation do people need to make on that front?
Well, I do extensive counseling with my clients on issues like this. First of all, the goal of spiritual warfare from the enemy's point of view is to destroy and to split a church. And there are a number of ways you can do that, but one of the ways often comes up in zoning, and I've seen this with many clients. So the pastor comes in, and he has a word from God, and the word from God is that, you know, we're going to do this renovation, or God's told me we're going to buy this church, or we're going to build, or... And he has a grand vision of what God is doing, and he presents it to the congregation and builds them up really greatly. And they're very excited, but then the zoning comes in, and they lose. I had this happen in Oak Park. And when that happens, it oftentimes can cause a great deal of confusion within the church, loss of respect for the leadership, and all kinds of, you know, difficulties. So one of my concerns is that leadership has to be very, very careful in how they work with the congregation when they're going and starting a new building project. otherwise, you can see a great deal of problems come up and a real crisis for leadership if they're not successful.
So when we talk about spiritual warfare, I want to be quick to also say to people, I think that there are times that we tend to, because it's the church and because we imagine that we're so certain that what is supposed to be built is supposed to be built, or we're so certain that what we're supposed to get to do is what God wants, that we demonize people on the other side. And sometimes,
I try to be very careful. I really agree with
you.
Yeah,
I'm not suggesting you do that. I'm suggesting
we all do it.
Yeah, we all do it a little bit.
Our cause is the right cause, and if it's not going forward, it's Satan that's doing it. So,
that's why I appreciated. Yeah, I appreciated what you said about, you know, sort of these legitimate concerns that neighbors have about noise or parking or fearful of the disruption to the neighborhood, that a church, particularly a church that might grow substantially in size. People have legitimate concerns about their own property value. They have legitimate concerns about who's going to be there at all hours of the day and night. And so I think that one of the lessons I have learned from you over the years is we have to really establish ourselves as good neighbors in order that we have good relationships with the municipality where we're operating, in order that when the time comes for us to do something like we're talking about, build a new building or an addition on an existing building or improvements, that we already have the relational equity that we can go and spend in City Hall. And we also already have the relationships with the neighbors to be able to say, this is what we're contemplating. We're hoping you'll be our partners in it as, you know, as we're really seeking to serve the community.
Carmen, I would use another term for that, and you develop that. You can't always have that when you're starting, but I totally agree with you in terms of it being relational. The word I use is shalom. And that what peace are you bringing to this community with your church? People assume that because you're a church, you know, it's a good thing. Your neighbors don't assume that. And so the question begins, what peace are you bringing? What's your shalom? And I try to help my clients really see that. I had a black congregation down on the south side, and they were going into an Irish neighborhood. They wanted to buy a car dealership and turn it into a church. And they were a great congregation. It would have been a wonderful situation, but the community just didn't accept them. And that pastor, to my great amazement and just really blessed me, he wasn't angry, he wasn't out for revenge, and he just said, you know, if we can't bring shalom to this neighborhood, we can look elsewhere. And I just thought there was a tremendous amount of maturity and respect and responsibility in that man. So we do need to have that view of, we have certain rights, that's true, but we also have certain responsibilities, and as God's people, there's a real fine balance that goes on there.
Well, and that story reminds us all, you know, of Jesus basically saying, look, if they won't have you, shake the dust off and move on. And so I appreciate you sharing
that. I go both ways on that. Sometimes I think, no, that community really needs to get shaken up. And I think it's a discernment matter. And I couldn't say one is right and the other is wrong. I really think it depends on the situation. Let me just throw in one thing you were asking about spiritual discernment and spiritual warfare. We have a very, very old zoning case in the Bible. And that is the reconstruction of the temple when they came back from Persia. And if you really look at the books, Nehemiah and the other books, you'll discover that there was about a 20-year zoning battle that took place to reconstruct the temple. They initially got permission to go ahead, and even the king said, we're going to supply the materials for you. But then we call them NIMBYs, not in my backyard. The NIMBYs came out in Jerusalem and tried everything they could do to stop them. And they tried threat of violence, but they also used the courts. And so if you go back, even in history, the second temple, which was promised by God, was held up by a zoning battle that took about 20 years.
Rich Baker, see, now I love that. We so appreciate you bringing the Word of God to bear on this conversation. Friends, that is Rich Baker. You can find him at mockbaker.com. And you can, if you need, you know, if you need help in these conversations, these are good guys to turn to. They are affiliated with the Christian Legal Society and with the Alliance Defending Freedom. We certainly appreciate everything that you guys do on Lawyers for Jesus. Thanks for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you.
Hey, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about John McCain and a life well lived, worthy of the calling to which he was called. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back.
Word of God, speak, would you pour down like rain, washing my eyes to see your majesty.
Hey friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I didn't want to have today come and go without, or at least having a brief conversation about the life and service of Senator John McCain. Certainly, by now, you are aware that that his life on this earth has come to an end. He succumbed to glioblastoma, which is a particularly virulent form of brain cancer, on Saturday. And so services are going to take place this week, both in Arizona, his home state, and then in Washington, D.C., where he will be eulogized by two past presidents, actually, notably, the two past presidents who he ran against unsuccessfully in his own pursuit of the U.S. presidency. So in the year 2000, John McCain sought to be the Republican nominee, and he was beat out by the person who ultimately won, and that was George W. Bush. And then in 2008, Senator John McCain ended up as the Republican, the GOP nominee for president, running against Senator Barack Obama. And we all know that Barack Obama ultimately prevailed in that election. And so I think that it is, it says a lot, it speaks volumes about John McCain, that those are the two men who will be offering words of remembrance and eulogizing him at the formal, I think we would call it the state funeral, which will take place in our nation's capital later this week. I want to begin with this. The Apostle Paul begins the fourth chapter of his letter to the Christians at Ephesus in this way. As a prisoner for the Lord, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. As I was thinking about the life and testimony and character of John McCain, this is the verse that the Lord brought to mind. As a prisoner for the Lord, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. I can think of no better verse of Scripture to describe the life, the service, and the sacrifice of Senator John McCain. So as you consider his character qualities, and they are many, integrity, self-sacrifice, authenticity, moral courage. He's been described as the conscience of the Senate. He was a man who would not be moved. Some people found that utterly frustrating, but he was who he was. I want us to also consider the calling that John McCain hoped to inspire in others. He hoped to inspire a life of civility and civil service among others. And so I think that when we think about how one life impacts many other lives, the impact of the life of Senator John McCain is really, well, it's hard to know right now in this moment, but I do believe that history will look back at the life of this one man and say, wow, that's a person who lived a life really worthy of the calling to which he had been called. And for John McCain, that was a life of public service to the United States of America. He was a patriot. I think that if any one word is going to be used to describe him, it will be that one word. So there are lots of things that we might, as Christians, mention about him. And I think that, you know, in terms of all of the nice things that we might say about him and his service to the country, I think that as Christians, one of the things that we bring to the conversation is, well, what was the role of faith in this man's life? So we'd have to look back to his second campaign for the presidency in 2008, when we actually have some record of him talking about his faith. Even then, he tended to tell stories about silent expressions of belief in God, not demonstrative evangelistic efforts on his part. In a family memoir, and in an ad campaign, and I feel like in an interview that he did on air with Rick Warren that I seem to recall in some recess of my mind, John McCain tells this. It's literally a momentary story, but it's obviously significant for him. And it's this: he recalls guard in his prison POW camp in Vietnam, who on one Christmas stood in front of McCain in the dirt courtyard. They said nothing, but the man with his sandal drew a cross, in the sand of the courtyard, or the dirt of the courtyard, and then just looked at McCain. There were no words. McCain talks about a whole minute passing before the man rubbed the cross out with his sandal and just walked away. McCain said this: for a minute there were just two Christians worshiping together. And so we don't and we won't hear that story retold by secular media this week. That's my guess. We probably also will not hear the stories that others told from inside of that POW camp in Vietnam. But during his 5.5 years in that POW camp, McCain, others have said about him, he really drew on his Episcopal roots. His great grandfather was an Episcopal minister, and John McCain attended Episcopal schools and boarding schools his whole life. He wrote a memoir called Faith of My Fathers, in which he recounted that he prayed more often and more fervently when he was in prison than he ever has as a free man. And others who were imprisoned with him talked about what a good preacher John McCain was. Apparently, there were opportunities for them periodically to get together, and one of his one of those who was a POW as well said of him, McCain remembered the entire liturgy from those Episcopal services he grew up in. He recited them word for word. On one Christmas day in captivity, John McCain recalls in a memoir that he was the room chaplain, and therefore he was given a few minutes to copy passages from a Bible, and that they sang hymns with emotion, Christmas hymns, and that he would read portions of the story of the birth of Christ. He said, "It was more sacred to me than any service I had ever attended in the past and any service I have ever attended since." He was certainly a man of prayer, and he was acquainted with great suffering. John McCain never really wanted to be identified with any part of what we would describe as the religious right, and there were certainly people of religious faith who he found profoundly distasteful. But I think that we can say of him that where some people talk a lot about their faith, John McCain is a person who seems to have very quietly lived out the faith. And so I think that, as Christians, when we consider his life and we consider his legacy, I'm just going to encourage us to consider what Paul means writing from prison as a prisoner for the Lord, what it means to challenge one another to lead lives that are worthy of the calling to which we have been called. We certainly have been called by Christ to be his ambassadors in this generation. Some of us to public service, some of us to other forms of service, but each and every one of us to lead lives worthy of the calling to which we've been called. Hey, I want to thank you for your prayers. Many of you communicated that you were praying for me on Saturday. I actually am going to share with you about the Christian Transhumanism Conference tomorrow here on Connecting Faith. That's all the time we've got today. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.